He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora, Ingrid here. Welcome to today's episode of Morning Report Essentials. It is a short week, of course, for us. No shortage, though, of political news and drama. We have a new Minister for Media and Communications, Paul Goldsmith. This is as a result of a couple of ministers being sacked on Wednesday. We talked to the political panel about that too. And a bit of an Anzac theme as well for the show today, Ben.
Yeah, that's right, Ingrid. We talked about the Warriors, firstly, the rugby league game, which unfortunately they lost on a massive Anzac celebration night against the Gold Coast Titans. But we also talked to one of New Zealand's best military historians, Chris Pugsley, about the celebrations here and abroad. It was fascinating talking to him, particularly about Wellington's pesky wind. So hopefully you enjoy the listen. New Media and Communications Minister Paul Goldsmith says he'll be looking at how the government can level the playing field between traditional media providers and streaming platforms. Mr. Goldsmith has replaced Melissa Lee, who was stripped of that portfolio this week after coming under pressure in the wake of huge job losses in the industry. A few minutes ago, I spoke with the new minister and began by asking him what he considers the main challenges facing the media industry.
The old models, the old ways, relying on advertising revenue has obviously come under pressure. The way that people get their information has changed dramatically in the last decade, and that, of course, has led to a big change of how revenues flow, and so that requires change.
What do you make of the work of your predecessor, Melissa Lee?
Oh, well, she did her very best, and I'm obviously not going to be disparaging about that. Prime Minister's asked me to do the job, and I'm going to do it the best I can.
She was obviously criticised for how she handled, particularly around the News Hub closure. What might you have done differently?
Well, I'm not going to speculate about that. I'm just going to do the best I can, which is identify the challenges that we've got and plot a path forward. And, recognising that all around the world, the various elements of the media, some are struggling and, some real challenges out there. So part of the solution is to try and level the playing field as best we can between, what you might describe as traditional providers and the streamers, recognising that, people's behaviours have changed. And so there has to be adaptation as well.
And so in identifying some of those issues, I mean, is there a healthy looking handover note from Melissa Lee to help you get started in that?
Oh, yeah. Well, look, a lot of good work has been done. And, obviously, as a new minister coming in, I'll spend a bit of time talking to, the key players and form my own opinions as well. And so it will take a little bit of time, but I'm conscious of the fact that there's some urgency in some matters that we've got to deal with.
Do you think this is an industry in crisis?
Look, I would say it's, there are areas where there's real pressure, and people are doing their best to adapt, but you've got some real challenges naturally with the massive power that the big streaming companies have and the impact that that's having on revenue. And like I say, people have to adapt, and from a government point of view, we've got to do what we can to try and level the playing field as best we can.
So could that include legislating so that Facebook and Google, these big online platforms, have to pay New Zealand media companies as they do in Australia?
Well, I mean, that's obviously something that some countries have done, and obviously it's the sort of thing that we'd be looking at.
Public interest journalism fund, is that another thing that you could bring back? Is that something that in hindsight was fairly helpful to the media?
I'm not going to run through a list of hard statements, on the second day of the portfolio, but, there are a range of issues you've got to work your way through. I'm going to do that in as timely fashion as I can.
Now, I understand Melissa Lee had done quite a bit of work on some plans that she intended to show Cabinet around, how to help save the industry. Have you seen those plans and will you be tweaking and that sort of thing?
I'm not going to talk about the sort of cabinet process, but yes, obviously work has been done and obviously I'll be building on that work.
And there was a suggestion that maybe those plans hadn't been approved or shown to Winston Peters. Will that be something that you'll be making sure you do in future?
The coalition's working very well at the moment, and we're going to do our bit, and I'm going to sort of carry on in that vein. We've got a lot of work to do as a country, a lot of fundamentally around the economy and restoring law and order and all these things. I feel like we're making good progress, and I've got no doubt that we'll have a good constructive conversation across the all the coalition parties.
Time for our weekly political panel. This week we are joined by RNZ's political editor Joe Moyer and New Zealand Herald political editor Claire Trivette. Good morning and welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Okay, so we had a short week, obviously. Still no shortage of political drama, with one of the big stories of the week dropping on that Wednesday evening as we headed into Anzac Day. I'll go to you first, Joe. I'm talking, of course, about Melissa Lee and Penny Simons being demoted Lee dropped from cabinet, but losing their portfolios. What did you make of how the Prime Minister handled that?
Yeah, look, I think this was a situation where Christopher Luxon decided he was going to nip things in the bud early. I mean, he had seen what has happened with both Labor and with the Green Party as well in terms of letting some of these issues drag out. You know, I'm thinking the sort of long list of ministers that you saw cause issues and get given second chances by both Jacinda Ardern and Chris Hipkins and then inevitably ended up having to go. The Green Party has obviously been criticised this year already around its handling of Gowri's Garman and Darlene Tana and dragging those issues out. Christopher Luxon probably took one look at that and thought, let's just get this sorted, because the headlines were bad and they were continuing over and over again. There was also the possibility, I guess, that if he didn't nip things in the bud early, that if it carried on, it would end up being his reputation that would end up, getting caught in all of this as well. And anything that played out in the future would extend to him and his leadership. So, the fact that he went in early, got in early and got it done is probably going to work out better for him in the end, but it also sends a message to the rest of his National Party ministers that, you know, bad performance, lack of performance is a sackable offence now. That, of course, won't extend, though, to Acton New Zealand First, who he doesn't have the same sort of ability to discipline, I guess.
No, is that a sort of signal to those other members of the Cabinet who aren't members of his party that he's trying to set a standard there? Because 5 months, that is, that's harsh.
Yeah, I mean, it does create a threshold, doesn't it? Because it sort of says, well, this is the sort of performance or lack thereof that leads to losing your portfolios, and in Melissa Lee's case, being dropped from cabinet. But, you know, what does that mean for behaviours or commentary from other ministers and other parties who, you know, it will fall to Winston Peters and David Seymour more so to deal with their ministers in those areas. That's always what has ended up happening with coalitions is, you saw that with Jacinda Ardern. She never got involved with New Zealand First ministers at the time. It was Winston Peters who dealt with it. So when you set a threshold like that, but it can't apply to everyone because of the makeup of your coalition, that becomes, pretty difficult to navigate as well.
How will Paul Goldsmith go in the role? We've talked earlier about it being a tricky one. We've seen many people struggle in the portfolio, and of course, the troubles continue. They escalate.
Yeah, well, Paul Goldsmith started off fairly well, primarily just by doing interviews. He hasn't said much, admittedly, which is fair enough. He's only had the job for a couple of days and he's over in London doing other stuff. But he didn't seem to suffer from Melissa Lee's concern that if she didn't interview, it would be boring, at least. Mm. So it's good that he started off that way. He's got a pretty level head on his shoulders, and he's got kind of a background in kind of commerce roles and stuff like that, which possibly helps a bit quite well with dealing with one of the sectors of commerce, which is the media.
Yeah, so, sure, because, I mean, Melissa Lee had sort of often talked about the fact she'd been a journalist in a past life, but the troubles of the media go beyond, what the media is creating. It's those settings of sitting above that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the business setting of them, really. We'll see how he goes, but, I mean, I wasn't surprised that Melissa Lee got moved on from that role. I mean, she'd been the opposition spokesperson for 6 years, and apparently she had come up with a policy, but National had never actually put it out, so clearly it didn't pass muster with the top of the leadership team for them to be willing to campaign on it. I'm not sure what that would have even said, and that's part of the problem she had, is that when the trouble started hitting the fan, nearly swore on RNZ, when the trouble started hitting the fan, she she didn't have a kind of policy to lean back on, really. So now it's left to Paul Goldsmith to look at what is happening around there, around Fair Digital, the digital Fair Digital Trading Bill and all the other kind of settings, and see what he comes up with. I don't know whether he'll get much further than her on those lines, because it is kind of the whole National Party, the whole government has to agree with whatever they do. So, but, you know, at least he's willing to take it on. Well, he may not be willing. He may have just been told he was willing. So, yeah.
Before we move on, I just wanted to ask, Simon Watts, as part of this reshuffle, has been moved up into Cabinet. This is the first time in how long that a climate change minister has actually been in Cabinet. Is that big news, or will he be able to do anything?
Well, it was James Shaw who wasn't in Cabinet, but didn't seem to be too disempowered by not being in Cabinet. They would always go into Cabinet when they were talking on a climate change issue. Simon Watts, like Penny Simmons, actually, are both 2020 crew. So he's considered very capable. He is quite capable. He did well in opposition in the 3 years he had there. I would say that promotion is almost more merit-based than portfolio-based. It is almost, you know, Luxon will see it as a bonus that he's in climate change, because it kind of sends a message, really, that they do have climate change around the cabinet table for a government which is coming under fire on the environment and climate change measures. So a bit of a kind of double reason there for him to move up.
Simon Watts was just really unlucky to miss out, I think, in November last year, because of how many New Zealand First Enact ministers they needed to bring in. He would have been in there anyway. He's close with Luxon, and Luxon rates him. So, and like Claire says, it helps with sort of get rid of some of that criticism that's been going on about climate and environment type issues not being at the cabinet table.
Just on, if we move on to fast track consenting, Chris Bishop releasing the 200 stakeholders in the dying hours before the consultation closed. Shane Jones says it's all about mining. How have the government handled all this, Claire?
Yeah, I think they're aware that it's starting to get a little bit messy. So there's been a fair bit of criticism of the way they've set up that fast-track consenting in the past couple of weeks. Submissions are now closed, but there'll be oral submissions during the select committee process. So Chris Bishop's gone on the front foot a bit and has written an opinion piece which is in the Herald this morning, in which he's put out his sales pitch for the fast-track consenting. He's chosen in that to emphasise the housing projects, the roading projects, the renewable energy projects, and downplay the mining stuff, which has become a problem for them because Shane Jones, one of the consenting ministers, keeps banging on about mining and drill baby drill and stuff. So there started to be a perception that it was all about opening the way for mines popping up all over the country. Bishop set out the reason for cutting the red tape, which is basically $1.3 billion spent every year just on paperwork for consents, holding things up, projects that New Zealand kind of needs. And he's also indicated in that they are willing to bend on some of the things that people are finding the most objectionable. He said some of the response has been overblown, and I suspect by that he's talking about the kind of core Greenpeace and those environmental groups' responses. But he said some has been more reasonable. If he thinks that all the criticism is coming from what he might consider the Greenies, then he needs to read those submissions, because there are quite serious concerns raised by more eminent people such as Simon Upton, the minister who actually was the architect of the RMA in the first place and is Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment, and the Auditor-General and the New Zealand Initiative, all of whom have questioned the ministers having the final decision-making on that, pushing for stronger conflict of interest steps and more transparency around the lobbying that might take place and what links ministers might have, and for ministers to have to specify the reasons why they might accept a proposal or, you know, reject the expert panel's recommendations or whatever they do. So I would say that those areas are kind of roundabout where we might see the moves from the government to tidy it up a bit.
I think the conflict stuff is going to be interesting, though, and we've already seen this play out a little bit with Thomas Coughlin had a story this week about that, and where you've got sort of part owner directors of some firms who have been approached as part of these stakeholder groups, and, you know, donations to Shane Jones and New Zealand First. You've had Chris Bishop talk on the record about the fact, of course, there's going to be conflicts of interest in this space because it's New Zealand, you know, hello, 0 degrees of separation to anyone or anything. But I think going forward, that is going to be problematic because in this industry area, there are going to be donation issues when it comes to parties and ministers, and there's also just going to be relationship issues, and they're going to have to work through that, and that stuff is going to end up in the media, and they're going to be fighting fires on it as well. So it is going to be quite a difficult one, I think, to navigate over the course of the term as to how they sort of be seen to be transparent but also deal with some of those conflict issues too.
That is time to cross the Tasman now and have a chat with our Canberra correspondent Kerri-Anne Walsh. Good morning, Kerri-Anne.
Good morning, Ingrid.
Obviously, both of us are celebrating Anzac Day or commemorating yes. Anzac Day. The gatherings around your country, what, at record levels as well?
Oh, yeah. Every year. It's increasing every year. I went to the dawn service here in Canberra at the War Memorial, which is a big one, and there was something like 30,000 people there. I mean, it was insane. I don't live too far away. And I left home with my son and his partner at about 4:30, something like that, to get there by 5 to get a reasonable spot. It started at 5:30, and it was already, you couldn't get anywhere close to it. So it's quite an astonishing thing to see around the country that we really do come together as a nation, and we enjoy the mateship. Everybody goes to the pub after, or breakfast, or whatever they do, and there's a general sense of well-being, which is not evident on other days, particularly on Australia Day.
Mm, bit of a contrast there. I'm not sure if you're aware, our Defence Force people who were actually at Gallipoli for this commemorations this time around had lost some of their baggage, and your guys helped them out with we lost our bugle. And they gave them a cornet. Oh. I don't actually know what that is, but it's a bugle-type object that they were able to help out. So the Anzac spirit was alive and well Anzac Cove there too.
Yeah.
Not such good news. Seven teens under arrest and in custody on the terror-related charges. This is the police are laying charges following the stabbing of the Assyrian bishop a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, well, this is a horrifying step up from what we considered to be, when it was first dead, an isolated incident of a 15-year-old who had stabbed this Assyrian bishop as it was being streamed live. He was arrested, he was charged, it was nominated as a terrorist attack. But in its wake, there's been these teenagers ranging in age from 15 to 17 who were all on a WhatsApp chat group sharing extremist material, including the one that did the stabbing. And they've all been arrested on charges related to the incident and sharing terrorist material. The police believed that they had to be kept behind bars, including a 14-year-old who was going to be allowed out on bail until the prosecution stepped in and said, we're going to be mounting a challenge to that, so keep him behind bars for the time being. But they believed these young boys to be of such threat to the community that they had to be locked up and they had to be arrested now. They wanted to continue to look at them and to surveil them, but they said, nope, it's time to bring them in. What is happening out there in Western Sydney that these young people are being indoctrinated? There's all, of course, a lot of theories flying around, one of them which is, of course, social, the spread of misinformation and hate speech on social media. But it's pretty terrifying that such young men have such extreme thoughts and want to do harm to the country that they live in.
Yeah, no, that is a worrying trend. And just finally, this is a horrible stat about the number of women murdered by partners or people they know in Australia.
Yeah enough. Enough is enough. We've now, one woman every 4 days is being murdered in Australia in domestic violence-related incidents. Well, far more than an incident. It has the latest one, a horrifying incident, a horrifying event in Forbes in regional New South Wales has prompted a review of bail laws by that state. We can't go on like this. This is an argument we have been having for decades about the increasing level of violence against women here, and why don't we do anything about it? I can't understand it. It's terrible. It's a horrifying statistic, and women of Australia have had enough. We're sick of it. We want to see something happen.
It was an Anzac Day occasion to remember, or perhaps forget, in Auckland yesterday, with another sold-out crowd on hand to support the Warriors. The home side couldn't shake off some pretty concerning early-season NRL form, beaten 27-24 by the lowly Gold Coast Titans. After racing to a 12-0 lead, the Warriors conceded the next 27 points before a late fight-back fell just short. Sam Hewitt commentates on Warriors games for media outlet SENZ and joins us now. Kia ora, Sam. This is pretty concerning, isn't it?
Well, concerning probably is the right word at this stage, Ben. Two losses, like you said, to teams that are very much down the bottom of the NRL ladder, and the Gold Coast Titans, who hadn't even had a win in 2024. So I know sometimes Warriors fans can be a little bit emotional. I think they've sort of got reason to be a little bit now. Through eight rounds of the NRL, we haven't quite seen the Warriors team that we saw in 2023.
They seem to be, do you think the crowd was let down given such a big occasion, massive atmosphere, and then a performance like that?
Oh, 100%. Like, I try not to be, I guess, too harsh on a team given, you know, it's only been two really bad performances. But you're right, it's an Anzac Day game at home, which the Warriors haven't had since 2015. So much meaning in that day for both Australians and New Zealanders. But to have it at home at Mount Smart with you know, 24,000 people and all the ceremony going on beforehand, I was actually hearing in the game afterwards as well, the commentators saying, you know, there's no excuse for you not to put out an absolute, you know, 110% performance given the importance of the day. And you're right, Warriors fans were let down. That's a game they should have won, not just because of the day, but because it was the Titans, a team that hadn't got a win, a team that was right down the bottom of the ladder, a team that leaks points for fun, and a team the Warriors should have put away. They really should have put them away.
Even in the worst of times, Warriors fans are pretty impressive. They often stick behind the team. But does this risk that next level of fanaticism that's happened over the last year sort of waning?
Yep. Absolutely. And you can probably see that on the social media channels. That is, like you mentioned, the Warriors bandwagon. It is a little bit fickle at times, but that's at the end of the day, that is sport. It's what it's based on is performance. And Cam George, the CEO of the Warriors, has said this for years and years and years. The only way to keep the club going successfully and to get people to the games is to win. As soon as you start losing that, you're going to get people turning away. And I think the difference from last year to this year, Ben, and there were games last year that we lost. There was actually three in a row we lost last year with a similar record through 10 rounds that the Warriors are facing at the moment. But the games that were lost last year were games where the Warriors competed. They were close, even though they did lose on the scoreboard. It felt like they had won certain areas of the game. That's not happening through the losses this season. And I think that's why some Warriors fans are turning off and saying, you know what, this ain't the team from last year, and I'm just going to go take a time out for a couple of weeks.
What do you think the coach needs to do, Andrew Webster? What changes should he make?
Well, he's got to fix, there's two real key areas, and I know this is going to sound cliche, attack and defence, but there's two key areas he's really got to fix. The goal line defence at the moment is I think statistically one of the worst in the competition, and this is from a team that in 2023 had the best defensive record in the NRL alongside the Penrith Panthers. So something needs to change defensively on the goal line. I'm not sure whether that's positional shifts, whether that's some sort of strategic move, but the goal line defence needs shoring up and fast. The other end on attack, look, I want to see, I've said this for the last couple of weeks, I want to see Roger Tuivasa-Sheck moving to the wing. The centre experiment isn't really working. We've had eight games of it now. I would have thought that was long enough. Marcelo Montoya's not getting the ball he needs from Roger. Roger's not getting the ball at the right time to be able to take on defenders one-on-one. And look, the best game Roger played, well, one of the best games he's played, one of the best games the Warriors played was against the Rabbitohs, where Roger played on the wing. So why not shift Roger out to the wing? You can bring in Ali Leotoa, the young New South Wales Cup boy who's an absolute gun, to play in the centres, spark a little bit of attack, and maybe it's about just finding something, Ben. You know, the Warriors need to find something here on attack, because at the moment they're getting all these sets, all this possession, they're completing at 80%, they're kicking well, but they're not getting points at the end of it.
Anzac Day commemorations yesterday were laced with protest and calls for peace. In Gallipoli, Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters delivered a dawn address in which he said the world had become increasingly troubled and that diplomacy was needed more than ever to de-escalate conflicts. Back home, small groups of protesters, mostly related to the conflict in Gaza, attracted condemnation from the ACT Party. We're joined now by one of our foremost military historians, Chris Pugsley. Kia ora, Chris.
Kia ora, Ben.
If we start with Winston Peters, What did you make of his speech and his calls for diplomacy to come to the fore?
Well, I agree with it. And as Robert Patman said on this program, it was a very good speech. Put Gallipoli in perspective in terms of the ongoing cost to countries like New Zealand, and then related it to the world today. And everything he said is true. And it just pointed out that while diplomacy is essential, it has to be backed up by not just more than words. And it applies equally to all sides and all conflicts. So, yes, no, I've heard Winston a number of times speaking at Gallipoli, and he's in his element.
In New Zealand, there were obviously protests here, a lot of people highlighting the conflict in Gaza. Was that appropriate on Anzac Day?
Well, obviously, when you're having an Anzac Day service, you don't want protests. But in the context of protesting in New Zealand, if you think back, and someone of my generation looking back to the Vietnam era, and the Anzac Day service was a logical time to protest against New Zealand's involvement in Vietnam. And as we're seeing, particularly in the United States at present, those protests are in the university campuses, which mirrored what happened in the 1960s and grew from there. And so while you don't want them at a service that certainly isn't glorifying war but remembering the cost of war, the realities are that in today those protests will be noticed at national events, and you can understand why they happen.
There are also some complaints about the Wellington, the Anzac service at Pukeahu National War Memorial Park having to be cancelled due to Wellington's infamous wind. What do you make of that? I mean, I was taking the dog for a walk yesterday and almost got blown off the hill at Kandala. It was a pretty windy day.
Well, I was supposed to speak in Benburn Park at Karori at the 11 o'clock service there, and quite sensibly, the president of the Karori RSA had transferred it into the RSA club rooms, and just trying to open the door at in the street where Benburn Park is and where you get to the RSA club rooms was a struggle. So in situations where you're going to be blown out into the Cook Strait if you have it in the open, a sensible decision was taken. And obviously, the alternate venue was limited to 200 or 300 people. And so the right decision was made. Unfortunate, but, you know, the wind gods of Wellington determine how we live, and that's life.
That's correct. For anyone living in Wellington, they understand that. Over in Gallipoli, New Zealand's delegation had issues with their instruments going missing in Dubai on the way there. What did you make of Australia coming in and helping out?
Well, first of all, you've got the New Zealand Defence, a group of Defence Force personnel making that contingent up. And things happen. And as we know, on Gallipoli in 1915, the landing didn't go according to plan. Instead of a rapid advance across the peninsula and up the peninsula, they were trapped into a tiny perimeter without picks and shovels, without timber, having to bring water in to from offshore Greek islands, artillery limited to 5 rounds a day. And so they had to make it work. And I applaud John McLeod's team. They had a problem. They worked with their ANZAC partners, and we got a marvellous ceremony out of it. And so, hey, things happen.
And that's today's Morning Report podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Do tune in tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts from.
The Wild Turkey. RNZ National.